And from Dorothy Loss, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who today as I speak to you, continues to sit in a cage at the federal prison at Leavenworth, Kansas. Not for anything anyone, including even his prosecutor, has been prepared to say they actually know him to have done. Rather, as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous people within claimed boundaries. The claimed boundaries of the United States, and that's a point of emphasis that I want to return to towards the end of the talk today. There's a big difference between a claim and an actuality, a claim and a right. And the distinction between that claim and that right is a reason that Leonard Peltier sits in that prison as a symbol of the cost prohibitiveness, individual by individual, of actually standing on rights in this country, asserting rights in this country, and transforming the nature of this right-free society. Oh yeah, we're in Tempe, you thought it was smoke-free. No, different story, different story. But before I go into what I have to say today, I'd like to apologize to everyone that's here for the experience you must be having in order to hear me speak of being in this room. I mean, look around you. When I was younger, I spent time in farm labor. When I was younger, I spent time in factories. When I was younger, and this may be repeated, unlike the factories and the farm labor, I spent time in lockup, and I'm not quite sure which this most reminds me of. Now, normally, time permitting, I'd solicit everyone to come outside and we'd reassemble in a different configuration, not all these straight rows. We'd be able to interact in conjunction with other relations in a somewhat different way. Time doesn't really permit today, but as was pointed out to me by my friend Natsu Saito sitting over here when we were discussing it before the presentation, if we did go outside, we'd be sitting in a concrete amphitheater, basically an artificial hole in the ground, flanked on one side by essence of Normandy defense line architecture that seems to have been devised by Erwin Rommel, okay? To another side, we'd have a replication of the Stamheim maximum, super maximum actually, super maximum security prison designed for political prisoners in Germany. And then, I don't know, nouveau something or other undefinable that passes off as an aesthetic form to the third direction, and then in the fourth we get Roman carnival. Empire, repression, and repression. So I'm not quite sure what the statement would be that was carried to the group by virtue of the use of public space here. However, I do know this. Whatever is the appropriate terminology to define and characterize it, it has nothing to do with freedom, democracy, and a free exchange of ideas. This in the midst of a primary educational, I say that tongue-in-cheek, educational institution in the state of Arizona. This truly is the arid zone, and I don't mean that in terms of humidity and water flow. Oh, yes. I really didn't get turned around in time to see the show of hands, but how many people were at the presentation made by my old mentor, Tom Hayden, last night? Oh, yeah, that's a bunch of you. Often when I show up to events like this, I'm unsure of exactly how I'm going to frame what it is I'm going to say. I want to size up what it is that's going on and the people who are in attendance, what's happening, try to tailor my remarks to fit with the flow of things so it actually resonates and has some meaning. And I showed myself at Tom's presentation last night, and basically he gave me a venue to work with. Maybe I need to explain a little more thoroughly why I would choose to do that. So it goes really simply to this. In my formative years as an activist, he made reference to his 40 years of activism, and that's a pretty accurate count. Actually, it's a little longer, but I guess when you get to a certain age, you don't want to say how long things actually have been part of your life. Mine goes to about 35, and at the beginning of that 35, there were two people who really had a major influence in forming the way I looked at the world and the way I tried to make myself act within it. One was Tom Hayden. The other was Stokely Carmichael. Well, not that long ago, I had occasion to figuratively participate in burying Stokely, who would remain consistent with what it was he espoused in the stance that he took in those days, for the duration of his life. And last night I walked out with this incredible feeling of sadness. I cried when we buried Stokely. I didn't quite cry last night, but it was close, because Tom Hayden had buried himself. And that is a situation that speaks volumes. He made references to those days in ways that I'll remark upon in a moment and try to draw conclusions out of it. Now, I am not doing what it is that I'm doing here to trash Tom Hayden. He was my hero. Reference was made in a flattering sense to me being a hero, to the individual who introduced me. Don't have heroes. Heroes are transient. Draw lessons from people and let it go at that. And the lessons that Tom Hayden imparted when, as he put it, he was at his most creative and most constructive, which was also coincidentally in his own mind when he was, quote, most extreme, end quote, are things that cannot ever be taken away. And the loss of those things as a continuing reality and a nullification of a legacy is something that needs to be remarked upon. And we all need to draw the lessons from that, not to abuse him, but to continue to learn from him. In a way, I can say that I still am. In the day, I often found what it was that I wanted to give voice to myself in the words and the actions and the positions of Tom Hayden. And last night, I simply followed the same pattern, but the lessons to be drawn are very different. There was, you see, a time when Tom Hayden understood that the way you confront a process of imperialism, a process of genocide, the omnipresent reality of the United States on the planet, was not to set some sort of mystical goals for yourself and then be content with achieving minor and cosmetic changes to the structure of the system which perpetrates the imperial paradigm and the genocide that ensues from it. You do not confront genocide by liberal agendas. You do not take those who do not stand in the face of genocide and do what is necessary to bring it not to a modified form of delivery, but rather to a screeching halt. You do not hand them a justification for their inaction, to tell them that they're basically okay and can continue with business as usual, and in the process of participating in the system, reinforce and consolidate it. And that was the message that was delivered last night in a rhetoric about the implications of John Dean and the implications of liberal transformations of particularly onerous bits of order within the system while participating in those processes and those forms of politics which are approved by the system, sanctioned by the system, and there's only one reason that the state, that is the system, call it by its right name, will approve and sanction anything, and it's because in the process of approving and sanctioning, it understands that it is basically licensing a device to reinforce itself, to amplify itself, to consolidate itself, to confuse those who think they are in opposition. Tom understood that quite clearly. I know he understood quite clearly, both because of some passing remarks he made last night, but also because of the fact that he taught me that particular lesson. Now, that was then, and this is now. But we can draw some more detailed examples. And from those examples, we can learn. There was a day. There was a day when Tom Hayden understood the business of radicalization. That's an establishment term. I told an anecdote last night about taking a group of students from Harvard down to be participant observers. I think that was a term used. At Miami, in the events that were occurring there, that they were going to go to all sides, be objective, do analysis, and so on, so on, and so on, putting them into the conjuncture of opposition to the state on the one hand and the enforcement apparatus of the state on the other hand. And he made remark, actually it was quite funny at the time, of how those students got cut up in the immediacy of an incipient physical confrontation between the police and demonstrators, and that they had their hands up and that they were marching themselves backwards step by step saying, "We are dispersing, we are dispersing." And correctly pointed out, this is not the most militant chant that he had ever encountered in 40 years of activism. But despite the fact, this obvious retreat from militancy, of this obvious retreat from confrontation. Despite that obviousness, actually it was a demonstration of weakness, of vulnerability to the police, like sharks in the water when they smell blood. Honed in, and these students got an education. They were clubbed, they were grounded, they were maced, they were gassed, they were cuffed, they were taken off to jail. And then there's this whole thing about the institutional response of Harvard to it, and the individual parents of the students and the students themselves. And he's talking about the institutional discourse saying, well, how did this happen? How did we lose control of the situation? How did our students, our elite students, end up in this sort of circumstance? What's this guy Hayden about? What's his background? Who hired him? Is this a process that we used to talk about in the 60s, confrontation politics, of bringing those who are privileged and exempt and immune from the violence of the state into great direct confrontation with it so that they experience it, a process we understood to be radicalizing? The state adopted that term. No, it's not radicalization, he says. I didn't mean for them to get clubbed and gassed and cuffed and jailed. They didn't mean for them to get all those things done to them. In fact, even while it was happening, they kept expecting it to stop. And that's a testimony to privilege there. There's some of us that understand the nature of police power. So, no, it wasn't radicalizing, and that wasn't my intent. I intended them for just one moment to understand what it was like to be a member of an out rather than an elite community. I wanted them to understand, just for that second, the true nature of the exercise of power in this country, that it manifests itself in these, I think they call them 300-pound characters in their Star Wars suits with all this equipment of repression that probably these very students had felt was appropriate expenditure of public resources in order to maintain public order and the security, blah, blah, blah. I wanted them just for those moments to have the direct experience of those realities so that they could draw relevant conclusions. Excuse me, that's exactly the process of radicalization, of taking the privilege and putting them into conjuncture with the experience, the actual experience of two things. One, those who are on the receiving end of state violence, and thus to understand the true nature rather than the abstract nature of what's meant by rhetoric like law and order on one hand. And second, that it's exactly the projection of that violence which maintains their position of privilege. That was the process of radicalization. That was the basis of confrontation politics, as Tom Hayden, among many others, designed, devised, conceived, and implemented it. The repudiation, it's implicit to the denial, the appropriate terminology to what it was that he had set up as an educational experience, and that's what it was. That was an actual educational experience. Tends to speak droves. But in the end, having imparted these lessons, he draws the conclusions that somehow or another, we can unify around a relatively painless prescription for effecting social change, and in that process, increment by increment, vote by vote, statute by statute, initiative by initiative, candidate by candidate, somehow or another transform this society from the inside out so that it becomes the opposite of itself, because what he was imparting was a lesson with regard to the true essence of the beast in question. And the beast cannot be transformed into the opposite of itself. This was a lesson we once understood. The beast has to be eliminated. The beast has to be replaced with an alternative to itself. It cannot be tinkered with, adjusted. In other words, the whole bit about John Dean, in other words, the whole bit about running for office in the California legislature, in other words, the whole bit about the electoral process was a sham and a scam and an apology, a defensive mechanism for someone who lost the will to continue the struggle based upon a vision they had achieved. That's sad. That's sad in any case. It's especially sad when it is the case with someone who once saw things so clearly, took the salient position with regard to denying the relevance, was the word that was fashionable at the time, the applicability, ultimately I would say utility of that sort of thing, other than to demonstrate its sterility and its impotence to the people who are organized to try to assert themselves politically on that basis. What we're talking about last night was something different. And let me explain the lesson that ensues from that, because now this involves both Tom and Stokely. And ultimately, on that basis, since it is a monumental lesson learned, something that should be involving of everyone who fancies themselves to be in any way politically conscious and in any way politically active in this country now. Stokely put it this way, and Tom would have agreed. He said, I've been arrested and jailed 38 times for trying to register black people to vote, to exercise the franchise in the Deep South. He said this in 1964. So I've been arrested and gone to jail for that 38 times. And I have never, and I will never, cast a ballot. I don't believe in voting. I don't believe it does anything but co-opt you and bring you into the system of your own oppression. You are then participating. But here, it made sense. Here, it was important that we do sort of imbue that electoral process with a value it does not inherently hold. And the reason it was important is because the people that we were registering had been told they could not register. Casting that ballot, irrelevant in every other sense, was of absolute importance because they were told they could not vote. And when refusing to accept no for an answer was an empowerment on an individual basis and on a collective basis. The individual empowerment is necessary to the collective empowerment, and the empowerment both of the individuals and the collective is absolutely essential to gain the ability to exercise actual power, and that is the object, to attain power, because politics is the game of power. If you are going to be a political activist, you have to understand the nature of power and function on that. So you don't necessarily believe that the panacea, the end-game goal, and all the rest of that adheres to the particular organizing you engage in. You, on the other hand, as the organizer, must have the broader picture of what it is you're trying to organize, how it fits in to this larger whole, what it is you're trying to accomplish. In Stokely's case, it was quite clear. But to organize and empower the community so that they could research self-sufficiency and achieve self-determination and ultimately to separate themselves ultimately altogether from the society which had oppressed them, from the system that had oppressed them, and in the process of that detachment bring about the disintegration of the system of oppression itself. Radically different from the participation in the system which has resulted from the civil rights movement now. And again, as I say, in 1966, in 1967, in 1968, Hayden not only understood this, but extended the analysis and the set of objectives further even than Stokely had, ultimately to be co-opted and brought back in, and to devise a rationalization of how and why that might be too good, to the good, despite the fact that in his own analysis last night, he pointed to the falsity of the paradigm that he was putting forth as an alternative to the status quo. And he did it in a kind of an odd way, and it was in talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, which was transformative to the order of relations, social relations in the United States in some very tangible ways, created things like the Wagner Act, which legitimated the labor movement, allowed for the right to strike, alteration of conditions in workplaces, certain amount of workers' control, things like health insurance being guaranteed, consolidation of the 8-hour day and the 40-hour work week, overtime pay, Social Security apparatus, Federal Reserve guarantees on banks so that people would not lose their savings, and on and on and on. We got the whole list. And he himself pointed out that in these tinkerings, these adjustments, these alterations occurring within the parameters of the system, ultimately what was accomplished with this entire range of social objectives, economic objectives, policy objectives being achieved as a fundamental reinforcement of the system which had placed everyone in a situation of oppression in the first place. There was no fundamental challenge to the capitalist ordering of the economy and the resultant social and political relations. There was a cosmetic adjustment. There was a deceptive adjustment. There was a sense on the part of the people who were receiving benefits they'd never received before, who were abstract sort of way, were being dignified with a standing they'd never experienced in society, a sense that they had actually achieved a fundamental alteration, but that deception then prevented them from carrying through and fundamentally altering the system. That's the trap. Can we, within the context of the system as we encounter it, affect a change that will cause it at the base level to act in the world in any manner other than we conceive ourselves as opposing? Can we, by virtue of building better bike paths in Tempe, Arizona, hope to affect any kind of a fundamental transformation of the status quo? Can we, even in the ideal scenario where the building of better bike paths in Tempe could be extrapolated to every community in the country, insofar as every community in the United States was now endowed with better bike paths, or spandex-clad people with mushroom kind of helmets propose alternatives to fossil fuel-powered transportation and all the rest of that, ultimately transform the nature of the beast? I think you know the answer to that. I don't really have to go there, do I? And yet, how much time, how much energy, how much in terms of goodwill and good intention can be consumed in the struggle with individual municipal governments, state authorities, sometimes federal contributors and so forth, to attain better bike paths? I mean, this can be career trajectories for people who fancy themselves to be activists. When they're done, having won, they have better bike paths, mostly for the edification of the already overindulged. And that's the flat reality of it. You don't find poor people out there using bike paths. You'll find them in the street getting run over by cars because they're actually using it for transportation rather than recreation, and bike paths are a recreational use. For all the rhetoric about taking back something we never had, an elemental logic says you probably ought to have had it before you try to recover it rather than claim it. For all the talk about taking back the streets from cars, and they were after all built for cars, it will ultimately change nothing. System will figure out a way to adjust, to accommodate, if that's actually your demand, turn it into a profit, more profitable situation for itself, and ultimately an amplification and reinforcement of its own integrity by virtue of saying, we responded to public demands. Same will work in a lot of other areas that go towards what Murray Bookchin once called social anarchism, social activism, lifestyle activism in a way. You know, the fact of the matter is that even if you go to the notion that you can somehow or another transform elements of the system to make it act in a different way, it's not going to be accomplished on the basis of, oh, shall we run down the list? Have a more sharply, politically focused hip-hop group as a favorite band that we play incessantly. Music, counter to Pete Townsend, is not the revolution. Oh yeah, that's an old guy, and they're still doing that now. It's not going to come about with fashion changes. There's not a set of clothes you can buy that's actually going to change the world. Diet is not going to change the world. You can be a macrobiotic, you can be a vegetarian, you can eat nothing but meat, you can eat nothing but, I don't know. I don't have the full range of dietary possibilities in front of me. All I know that the transformation of personal ways of going about living life are supposedly imbued with a revolutionary content that I don't know if everybody in the room became a vegetarian, if it have any impact even on the municipal dog catching service. Do you? Do you really? Do you really? It won't come about by marching back and forth across campus, and even if you go off campus and march down the street all the way down. Tom was shocked to find the streets named Apache here. I don't know why. He wrote a book that was really a breakthrough in a way of including indigenous issues into the political paradigm of the opposition in North America. It was called Love of Possessions is a Disease with Him. He wrote it in 1971. He had a pretty good take on the nature of the genocidal process of consolidation of the United States, the deprivation of rights of indigenous peoples and how that related to others, but he seemed to have lost it. So much so that he was shocked to find the street might be named Apache in the United States. And by God, they're naming helicopters that as well. And what do you think the significance would be? He almost went somewhere and then backed away from it. But even if we took the march all the way down Apache to where it became Maine and we went from, I guess this would be Berkeley, hey? Okay, if we went all the way down into working class Oakland, it wouldn't really change anything. And if we had a rally and we could get all the people in this room multiplied by 10,000 and we set it out there That in and of itself wouldn't change anything. Even if we burned the right scented candles, chanted the right chants, and had the right bands perform, it wouldn't change anything, would it? Well, what if we harnessed all those people that came to that rally and had been into that march to sign petitions and go out and get 10 of their friends to sign petitions and send them into state government? Would that change something? Well, if it didn't change something, maybe we could have that translated through clever uses of the media to convince people that they needed to come out to replace these suckers who weren't paying attention to the will of the people as expressed into the petition. Would that change something? We put out a candidate who would listen. To what? To what? Do you think that you can vote people into office that will ultimately dissolve the structures of power and oppression of the United States? You believe you can? Well, there are a lot of people that delusional, and I do recommend certain therapy sessions that are conducted probably School of Psychology right over here. It's very unfortunate for you, very fortunate for Tom. I'm sure he's glad to hear it at this point that someone's agreeing with this. Okay? Now, ultimately, you're not going to be able to vote the system out of existence. You're going to be able to vote the system into defending its own interests and maintaining and preserving its own balance and integrity. That's all the system can do within the venues that are devised by, proved by, actually even demanded by the system. Any system of any sort would act in exactly the same fashion. The functioning of a system is to preserve and expand the functioning of the system. It's like the business of businesses to make money. I mean, this is a self-evident proposition. So you're not going to be able to vote it out. You can vote for these little ranges of change within the degree of sanctioned alteration that's allowed by the system. If you got somebody in there who actually had a vision that ran outside the box significantly enough to matter, and the will and the savvy to be able to push that forward into a concrete realization of an agenda, you'd be burying him right next to Stokely. You understand that. The qualifications for the job, to maintain the job, to continue to survive within the job, or to serve the interests of the system, create the appearance perhaps that you're doing the opposite, but ultimately, the system as a collectivity of intellects, is savvy enough to figure out when something becomes destabilizing, a threat internal to itself. It's going to get it out of there one way or another, and it's going to be either by expulsion directly on some set of pretext grounds, or it's going to be making sure that the party support necessary to allow for a re-election is not going to be there, or it's going to be, in the worst case scenario or the best case scenario, depending on how you want to view it, actual physical elimination. And we have examples of all three. So how about we go to court? Yeah, let's go to court. I mean, we do understand the law. This is, after all, as John Marshall put it in 1803, a government of laws, not men. So the law is paramount. You all understood that right from the get-go. They taught you that in space class, okay? Ignorance of the law is no excuse. You have to know the law. And since we know the law, or we can acquaint ourselves with the law, we can bring the law to bear. We can go into the due process venues. We can go into court. We can make an absolutely compelling case, compelling on sociological grounds, compelling on historical grounds, compelling on moral grounds, presumptively, most importantly, since it is a legal venue, compelling, absolutely irrefutable on legal grounds. And what is it you expect the court to do as a result of receiving this information? Enter a decree ordering the government to abolish itself. The court, by God, is part of the government. So all of these options, all of which are incredibly consuming in terms of drawing down the energy of activists, ultimately lead into a replication of the system. All of them, however, have a utility when approached in the right way. I'm not telling anybody not to organize in any way that makes sense to you, so long as you understand the nature of your organizing effort fits into a larger whole, so that we're not canceling each other out in these petty disagreements as to what the priorities ought to be and so forth. Priorities will be self-evident if we view this thing correctly. And anything that can be harnessed to the task of making progress to achieve the ultimate goal is not only permissible, but to be encouraged. Anything that's detached from the understanding of the ultimate goal, however, goes in the opposite direction. We understand then, we have an analytical lens then that allows us to be able to separate those who are part of the solution from those who are part of the problem. And it's the loss of that lens that seems to be afflicting my old friend Tom Hayden. Yeah? What do we mean by that? What is the problem? How do we structure it? How do we understand it? I have about 10 minutes remaining to talk, so we're obviously not going to be able to get a full picture on the table. I've talked mostly about what can't possibly work in and of itself. Let's talk about what would if we all, in the process of utilizing our intellects to arrive at a common destination where we actually repeal the injustice, structure of oppression, and so forth that we're up against in a meaningful fashion, what would it look like analytically? What would the consciousness have to be? What is this spectrum that is at issue in this conference? It has to do with justice, and it has to do with global on the one hand, local on the other. Yeah? Globalization is the current buzzword to go with the global. We understand implicitly, even if globalization is not the term used, that the issue is global if it's addressed in the United States, because the United States is the centerpiece of this phenomenon that is most recently called globalization. It's had other names because it's not something new. That's the first round of confusion, is that there's this new phenomena that we're confronted with out there. It's actually just an extension, a logical extension of that, of something we used to call imperialism. It was more often referred to as colonialism before that. And then we can track it all the way back. So we understand that it is a process, not an event. It has a history, and in that history, we can understand its nature, and in understanding its nature, we can figure out what's necessary to undo it. And if you're going to have globalization repealed in the interest of justice of the peoples of the world, you're going to have to look at peoples within the United States as part of the peoples of the world as well. You're going to have to look at the structural elements that allow globalization to occur. And what are the contingent aspects of this process? Those aspects that you must grasp if you're going to understand the predication for its existing at all? Well, first of all, it's the existence of a state. I don't mean the state of Arizona. I mean the state in the sense of a particular form of organization of a country. I mean a centrally situated locus of power, it's not diffuse, that dictates an order of relations that is enforced in an arbitrary manner upon all groups by whatever force is necessary to maintain obedience to the rules of that order. Now, I see people looking at me like, yeah? Yeah? Because they've got us indoctrinated to the point that we understand that to be a synonym for countries. There is no other form of country. Well, let me tell you, there is. Part of that has to do with a conflation that's been quite deliberate between the term nation and the term state. They use state as a synonym for nation. To be a nation, you must assume the order, the organization of a state. States have existed for about 200 years. People organized as nations have existed for thousands of years. There are presently on the planet about 200 recognized states, that is countries organized around this time. There are about 4,000 identified nations, and that's probably a conservative count. This entity over here that they call the United Nations, you have to be a state to be eligible for membership. It should have been called the United States, but when they organized it, yeah, you see where I'm going with that. We have to learn to distinguish between the two. All right, and that's the old process of systematizing a colonial order to make it an imperialist project. Okay, so that you have an entity that's organized in this way, imposing itself upon others that are not. These states imposing themselves upon nations. Inside what they claim is their corpus, and that goes to the claim of the boundaries of the United States as opposed to the reality. Internal to themselves, for purposes of their own construction and consolidation, and externally projected upon the world. And that's the old 19th century imperial model carrying over into the 20th century, the one that gets abolished during the so-called decolonization period of the 1950s and the 1960s. But somehow or another, despite that period of decolonization, the dismantlement of the old external empires that were maintained by the European powers, we have arrived at a point where we can now talk about the systematization of the economy, the projection of a political order that is truly global. It's not the old fantasy of world conquest, it's the actuality of it in a virtual form. We've arrived at that point. And the contingency for that is to extrapolate that state model out to megastate proportions. You had that in the old Soviet Union. Any of you think what I'm going to say next is kind of crazy, need to remind yourself that you go into any classroom in this campus that has a world map and you will be unable to find the Soviet Union. Okay? These things are not immutable. That one ceased to exist, at least in the megastate form that it did exist prior to 1990. We've got several remaining on the planet, and I could run through all that, which ones they are and what their potentials are, but you're sitting in the locus of it. The United States is the centerpiece of the projection of globalization, the imposition upon an anti-democratic order that is antithetical to freedom, that is antithetical to dignity, that is antithetical even to survival of the preponderance of the peoples of the world. And the United States is positioned to do that only on the basis of its consolidation of itself on continental proportions. But that consolidation in and of itself, and this takes us back to the local, and this takes us back to where we are now, is contingent upon the usurpation of the rights of the peoples whose land this is, the dispossession of those people of that land, the acquisition and incorporation of that land through illegal means by the United States, and the expropriation of the resources of that land for the United States to construct its economy. Let me cut to the chase on that. You've got within the claimed boundaries of the United States at the present moment, by its own count, well in excess of 400 separate and distinct indigenous nations, not states. Peoples, that's true, but insofar as the recognition is embodied by treaty in U.S. law, peoples eligible to exercise the rights of nations, that is, control over their own property, their own land base, the resources attend to that, to operate as polities separate and distinct from the United States, withdraw that territory and resources of that territory, not just in terms of what we call across the river here reservations, but the actually treaty delineated territories that have never been ceded by indigenous peoples and one-third of the territorial corpus of 48 contiguous states area of the United States disappears. And with the disappearance of that territory, those two-thirds of what the United States presently claims as its own domestic uranium reserves. With that, one-third of the territory goes fully 25% of the readily accessible low-sulfur coal. With that goes 20% of the oil and natural gas. With that goes all of the zeolite, all of the bauxite, all strategic critical minerals. The economy, as well as the geography of the United States, would be unrecognizable in the sense that it is entitled itself to conceive of itself. It would be unable to maintain the coherence of its internal or domestic political order on the one hand, and at the same time, concomitantly and self-evidently, I would argue, it would be removed in a position of being able to project itself in the fashion that we are all opposing upon the rest of the planet. Justice begins locally, and it doesn't begin with bike paths, and it doesn't begin with quality of life issues, and it doesn't begin with more parking meters, and it doesn't begin with making those people who privileged on the basis of the benefit accrued from the colonization internally of Native North America and the genocide concomitant to that to a better quality of life, and none of it, by the way, is being done for our kids. None of it. All of it is being done to consolidate the position of privilege occupied by those who are the beneficiaries. Refuse that on its face. Make the priority what it needs to be, which is a delivery of justice on a first priority basis to the first Americans. There is the first cornerstone for rolling back the system. It will not, however, be done by vote. It will not, however, be done by petition. It will not be done by rallies. It will not be done by marches. It will not be done by anything that could lead to a liberal reshaping of the system in order to maintain the sanctity of the status quo. It will have to be done every inch along the way in the fashion of struggle, kicking and screaming, knowing that the state will apply the means of power to maintain itself that it has readily in hand, and that is not a nonviolent process. This is my end point. There is no painful way, excuse me, there is no painless way to go about this. There is no comfortable way to go about this. There is no easy way to go about this. None of the things I talked about, there's not even a pill you can take to make it all better. We're going to have to reconcile our consciousness to the nature of the struggle before us, which is the literal dismemberment of the edifice of power as manifested in North America and projected upon the world in the terms that it imposes in order to maintain itself. And that has to do with the reasons why the ordinance is strapped to the hips of the cop, why they carry a handgun, why they carry a mace can, why they got pepper gas, why they got a riot. Did you know a riot gun is a weapon of mass destruction? You got an Arab American in Orange County, California, that's charged with possession of weapons of mass destruction because he had a pipe bomb in his car. And the argument is that it's a weapon of mass destruction because theoretically, at least, it would kill more than one person if it were detonated in public space. And that would be a perfect description, I would suppose, of a police scatter gun. So that's a reason the cops have weapons of mass destruction hooked to the dash of their automobile, and behind the police, the militarized components of the police which are proliferating around the country, which are the SWAT teams. Behind them you have the National Guard, and behind them you have, well, the federal enforcement authorities, and behind them you have the Army. Yeah, well, that's the federal end of things. Interlocking a little bit with the local red squads, but you have that whole array, and that whole array is anything but nonviolent. You cannot make a choice to be nonviolent. If you tangibly threaten power, if you actually are accomplishing something, they will utilize this physical force against you. You've created a violent situation irrespective of what your intentions may be. You need to suck it up and understand that and redefine the terms of engagement. Not to remain personally pure, comfortable, safe, or anything else, but if you're serious, if you actually are worthy of the name of a political activist, defining the struggle in terms of organizing and doing what is necessary to win. Decolonization of Native North America, by any means necessary. I would thank you for listening. We close usually saying all my relations, which in Lakota is Matakayasi, but I want to close another way because I was talking about Stokely Carmichael a little earlier on, and Stokely is symbolic of a whole broader milieu. So I'd like to close in a manner that's probably not been heard on this campus for about 30 to 35 years that I've been an activist, and it goes a little bit like this. Power of the people!